And there.
Thank you, Jane.
And the other hand,
it's summer. Oh, it's true, yes. Have you put your
hand? Oh, I haven't.
This is lovely.
I was going to say, thank you at the bottom.
Oh, this is what James and Claire back next week.
I don't know if...
I suppose there was nothing to compare with the Renaissance.
It was such a... It was terribly busy, although there weren't so many people then.
I think that it's we look at it as a very key moment in time because so many things that are nowadays society started then, like how printing really shaped us as a culture, as a society.
Printing wasn't there in the wasn't it about 14?
No, it's 14 something. In the West, it's just 1460s. Some stuff from woodblocks was printed, and images were printed also.
It shows woodblocks, yeah.
Yeah. It's literally a block of wood that you have to carve, and it's so time-consuming. I've tried once. It's also because you have to do that in reverse.
Yes.
Because you can't, even printers who print letters, you can't just put everything as it is. Because
it's got to be the right, the upside down.
Yeah, back to front. It's a skill you have to add and practice and tons of mistakes before getting it right, because it's crazy. So I guess even cities are a big thing. Cities nowadays, like London and Paris, it's this time that they become really big. So I think we look at it as a kind of like an elder brother where we come from. So when we try to understand it ourselves, the closest relative, it's this period in time and space. A medievalist would say that no, everything started in the Middle Ages. Classicist said, well, no, actually, etc. So it's a biased, a Renaissance person opinion, probably. So I said at the beginning of the class that if you had any question, please feel free to interrupt me. But then I kept on talking.
Yes.
So, do you have questions? Would you like to see again some works? Did you have like, oh, I didn't see that properly, or just anything? Somebody could ask me something about blue. Why blue was expensive? Just to say because.
Oh yes, I would like to know that.
Yes, and did they discover any new ways of?
Oh yeah, that's another interesting story. So, and they're connected. I find very fascinating history of covers. So, in those times, you could do blue in got black. We've got back to the blue. Sorry.
Oh, the blue. Lapis. Something like it is
there. You could do blue from two pigments. You could create blue pigment from two stones. One was azurite. And it's very, very common in Western Europe. This is for paint, not for cloth. It's an entirely different type of pigment for cloth. Or then you could use lapis lazuli. And lapis lazuli comes from the mountains of Afghanistan and India. Mm-hmm. The purest form is the Afghan one, because it's mixed up with gold and other minerals. So you have to have the purest slab, the purest stone in order to grind it and not to have an impure pigment. So Afghan lapis lazuli was really, really expensive. Imagine how that, I mean, to transport and sell it in those times. And as I was saying, as an example, the guy who painted Lucretia, an unknown woman that's called Lucretia, Lorenzo Otto, we have his will. And among the things he passed on, valuable stuff or his painting material, he also passed on to his heirs a couple of stones of lapis lazuli, because they were very precious to him, and he never separated from them, because yeah, you could make pigment from other things, but that was so much cherished as it was valuable as well. So for cloth, you need other pigments because they don't set as in paint, because kind of like a technical thing, pigments need a connector to stick to whatever you use as a support. And if in, say, tempera, widely speaking, there's a way of using eggs.
Mm.
And then there's oils. So oils become much more used from the late 15th century. And it's something that comes from the north. It's actually the Flemish, the Netherlandish painters who start to use them first. Probably because, well, trading, they got in touch with something else, because the European tradition was egg-based pigments. And so from the north, the Italian discovers them, they discover them from the Flemish painter. So this is another story that tells that it's not only one way, the kind of exchanges. Canvas as well, it's something they get, that the south of Europe gets from the north, because you could connect it to, again, a sailor culture, a culture of ships and trading on sea. And the Mediterranean sometimes was much closer as a sea. So it's first the Flemish that does it, and then a couple of Venetian painters, they discover it, and they say, oh, well, actually, that's much lighter to have it, because Venice, it's an island, and it's very shallow as land. If you see cross-section of the island, you just, like, put your fingers in your hair, because it's just, like, I don't know, 2 meters? It's so shallow. And so they have to use specific materials to build. They can't go that high. You don't have skyscrapers in Venice, and they had huge structural problems with the bell tower, the campanile, because that's why there it's the San Marco Square, it's the sort of lowest point of Venice, because there's too much stuff that brings it down. And canvas is much lighter than wood, so everything they could get rid of,
make it lighter.
Amazing,
isn't it?
So this was a bit of a sideway, but yeah, you can tell art from very different perspectives, and I mean, also cloth and dresses are a thing, but probably brings us to somewhere else that is not our destination today. So I don't know if you who came in slightly later and did you get all these things, or probably okay, just to say there's a couple of extra copies here. This is a bit more on the humanistic, the intellectual side, as I was saying. So I would talk just 1 minute, no more, I promise, just to give you a bit of context on Vasari. So this guy, who was a famous painter in his time, but not as big as the others. He left things and he was sought after, but it's not Michelangelo or others. He's actually very influential for this work, because other historians, other writers wrote of art in his time, but they weren't so influential in bringing together many, many threads. The presidents mostly wrote about collections. Oh, this wealthy person has these amazing paintings. He does a history. Of course, doing a history of painting and sculpting and architecture. So it's important that he tries to combine the fine arts. That's where we have the fine arts paradigm. It's not that goldsmithry, it's any less. It's just that these are the top ones, and we will see why. So he's the first to write a history, and that means to find a point of origin and an evolution. So, I don't know, did you have this impression that he is really stressing that this kind of, like, with natural or birth-like metaphors?
Oh, yes. It was very good. It needed the first painters and decorators and architects to start.
Yeah.
And whatever they did could be picked up and developed. Yes. I think that came through very well.
Yeah. He describes them as children, sometimes the childhood of art, right? So, and I mean, he is parallel with nature. There's also a lot of the same kind of metaphor of the cycle in natural terms, or the kind of like birth, and then decline. This is a bit more cyclical, because they say, haha, after the Middle Ages there comes us, and we are the rebirth. Isn't that the first preface, that at the end of it we have, should be page 6 in this one, they will now be able to recognise more easily the progress of art's rebirth and the state of perfection which is, has again ascended in our own times. Rebirth is this natural metaphor, and in the Italian it's rinascita. So where does our renaissance come from, Esther? The English uses by French because it's the renaissance, and for other reasons, academic reasons, or not because it owes to French art. But it's here the first time we read this rinascita, this rebirth. And so many people can disagree, and like nowadays you can say that, again, a lot of stuff was already happening. The medieval painters weren't like barbarians. But this idea that you have an awakening, a reawakening, and it's an awakening that looks past, but to look at the future, so you're a new child, reborn, and you have... You can reach perfection, new things. So, I said that just again, I'll go back to the little thing of the context. This is the second edition of the book. It's first published, you can find it, the table of content of this edition reports the fact that lives were added between the first and the second edition, because people became so interested that they said, well, I'm just going to add much more contemporary people. So in the second edition, the third part it's very, very big. It stopped at around 1520s and 30s in the first edition, and in the last it arrives until Michelangelo, who has died just 4 years before that. So he's still a contemporary. His tomb is still fresh in the sense that people are still shocked that they are in a world without him. I told you in the early hours, it's an artist that's very well connected with the rulers, with the Medici family, and the entire work is dedicated to Cosimo the First. This is not complete, unfortunately, because it's an abridged English translation, but it had all the right parts to show you. There's a huge prevalence to Tuscan artists. I mean, there's not only Tuscan artists in Italy, and there's not only Italian artists. So again, it's a very, very, I wouldn't call it narrow, it's a very chosen perspective. And other artists, other writers in that time wrote more about Venetian art, and others later started to write about their own place art. They started to write in the Netherlands. There's the equivalent, with the same big impact, the lives of the artists in Dutch in 1604. Because people start to look at art as a product of their own culture and their own nation. I mean, what they believe their own borders were back then. So this is this again. Something I wanted to ask you. So yes, we've talked about the different types of antiquity. There's a bit of the Greek, there's a bit of the Egyptians. But do you think that Vasari looks at all these antiquities, or he has a preference for a kind of antiquity? Does he think that there were some people that were doing that better? Isn't he maybe considering just Roman classicity?
Especially the architecture, I think.
Yes.
Significant.
That's very important, because sometimes when you read this, you concentrate. When you do art history, you sometimes concentrate on visual art. Then it's a bit of a loss from these times where they could do different things at the same time. And like artists like Raphael, Michelangelo did also very famous pieces of architecture. But they also wrote about them in the same way.
Particular capitals, they seem to get on a.
Yeah,
capitals seem to be real not a real, but a big issue that they weren't correct. And
yeah.
They had to
definitely
reevaluate it and go back and put them again.
Yeah, because capitals were like the first step to understand how architecture works in building up layers and elements. So something he mentioned as proportion, it's probably a way to understand what order means in architecture. So it's not only the capital, but how the capital works within the column, how the columns works within the floor, how the floor works within the building. And they have very precise, even mathematical proportions sometimes. And so, yes, this is still a time where they're like wrapping their head around this. How's the Doric? How's the Tuscan? How can we do that?
Can you just say that he also mentions Tuscan capitals each time? Mm-hmm. I've never come across those. What are those?
Yeah, it's it's not so widespread, because even in Roman times, it's a more it's a kind of order that was widespread, especially on the parts of Italy that were not ruled by Greece in Greek times, because all south of Italy was part of it was Greek dominions. It was called the Big Greece, Magna Grecia, because Athens, Sparta, other cities had dominions in south of Italy. In the non-south of Italy, they were still doing columns and these things in a similar way, but not the same. And that is called the Tuscan. Sometimes it's called Etruscan, call it. But it's not only the Etruscan civilization that uses it. It's just an Italic type of order. It's not so widespread as the other ones, because then the Romans used much more the Greek ones. But yeah, were there any other terms or things that you found I would like to understand it more, or because I can keep on, but maybe some of
you talked about the awkward Greek style in statues, that now they've got more movement and rendered them with better poses.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, but I always thought the Greek style was quite posed as well, but movement as well, but obviously not.
I think that it's very tricky when he mentions Greeks, because what I was trying to say is that he prefers Roman stuff, because that is the Latin stuff. It's unquestionably in a certain time and with a certain civilization. But then Greek, in this time, can mean two things. The Greeks, the ancient Greeks, but also the Byzantines. The Byzantines wouldn't agree, because they called themselves the Romans. Still in these times, they called themselves the Romans. But in the West, they were called the Greeks. So most of the time where he says no, the Greek way of painting as well, he mentions the Greeks don't paint as well. It's a Byzantine painting.
It makes more sense now, yes.
And that is the point. He's trying to go back in time, but also the portray a kind of art that it's the Western Europe. So again, maybe to say, well, actually, they're not really the good heirs of the Roman Empire. We could revive it much better. Something I would like to... maybe we can also read a passage more closely, but something I'd like you to point to you is... Yeah, we could actually read it, and then we can even discuss it. The very first one, it's just the first couple of paragraphs, so unless you don't mind, I can read it. And
repeat the preface, sorry.
So the first ever, the first, so part one, preface to the large.
Yeah,
part
one. Yeah,
so
yeah.
It should be page 3, but it has no number. So. I know it is an opinion commonly accepted. It almost sounds like Jane Austen. Among almost writers, that sculpture, as well as painting, was first discovered in nature by the peoples of Egypt. And then some others attribute to the Chaldeans the first rough carvings in marble and the first figures in relief. just as steel adders assigned to the Greeks the invention of the brush and the use of colour. But I would say that the design, the basis of both arts, or rather the very soul which conceives and nourishes within itself all the aspects of the intellect, existed in absolute perfection at the origin of all other things, when God on high, having created the great body of the Word and having decorated the heavens with its brightest lights, descended with his intellect further down to the clarity of the atmosphere and the solidity of the earth, and shaping man discovered in the pleasing invention of things the first form of sculpture and painting. So it's really the beginning. So he's saying two key things. Design, it's the, he says, the basis of both arts. Design in English really translates the concept that's behind disegno in Italian. But disegno is also drawing, so it's a material and conceptual level. And this is why the fine arts are such, and gold mystery maybe it's not, and coins is not, because they're not based on drawings. An architect can just draw a building and then somebody else builds it. Mm. But you're still an architect, you're still an artist. So the design was, this is one, a thing that we can actually see wasn't much there earlier on, because artists in earlier times where they were heads of workshops, they were masters, they were not intellectuals, because design is what brings them an intellectual status. They can even not work on their artworks. It can be the workshop. Raphael has such a massive workshop that some of the paintings that are ascribed to them, it's actually, there's nothing about him but the drawing. But the drawing in the sense of the design, the planning, and the preparatory drawing as well. So this is the thing that makes Renaissance artists intellectuals and different from afterwards. And painting and sculpture and architecture as nobler and finer arts. And also, just like God, discovered the pleasing invention of things. Invention is the thing that I've tried to describe as challenging, modeling yourself onto the ancients. Inventio as invention, and imitatio. Imitatio as imitation as a first meaning, but it really means also modeling as inventing something new. Where the key turns in this way of comparing yourself and creating something new. So he's really saying from the beginning the key things, that there's an evolution, that in some of the following paragraphs that we see that nowadays there's perfection. Mm-hmm. But there's these things, it's design that makes artists perfect. And it's invention that makes them godlike.
Can I just ask that? In that statement, he's also saying that assigned to the Greeks the invention of the brush, which is something materialistic. Mm-hmm. I took that to read as something, you know, the brush that you paint with. Mm-hmm. And then colour is something more. So you've got a sort of a contrast there, I felt, between something that was quite.
I think he is saying colour to mean a way of using colour.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm.
So also in a material way, in the sense how they mix the pigments, mm-hmm. how they use the pigments, and there's accounts of Greek paintings where they were using a style that's very realistic. So in this way of mimicking life, so also using colour, so mm-hmm. you're right. It's not only a material thing, but also, yes, it's the kind of like bread and butter of an artist's work. So how to use brushes, how to use colours. Mm-hmm. There's always this thing. And in the table, unfortunately, this table of contents doesn't show it, but in the second edition, he just inserts a big part at the beginning, unrelated, so not within the history, that talks about techniques. because techniques are important. I don't know, did you have the impression that he mentions here and then shadowing?
Yes.
Proportion, style. And again, proportion is the is an architectural thing, but it's also a way of foreshadowing and doing bodies in space. So it's something also can evolve itself because says, like the painters of the second generation did that very well, but then, oh man, there's Raphael, there's Michelangelo, they're doing so much better. And it's, I would say that Raphael is the one that goes beyond the nature, but then there's the one that becomes also, that goes also beyond humanity, which is Michelangelo. He was very, very fond of him. There's plenty of editions of this in online if you're interested, because it's been republished throughout centuries, in the 19th century, so you can find copyright free if you want to. There's a bit of gossip, and you can also read it as a bit of fan fiction by Pasani.
This is so, what's the word I'm looking for? Sophisticated. Just imagine how good those cave paintings must have been. Hundreds of thousands of years previously. Yeah. I mean, they were very basic, but for people that didn't have any art or anything, they were pretty, pretty brilliant.
I mean, it's also a decorative thing. It's not only mimicking life. So it's using art also in a much more kind of like conscious way.
Yes.
So definitely. And are there any other, I don't know, passages that brought your attention? Or did you, probably in a bit less in these prefaces, but much more when he writes the first part, he doesn't have that great opinion of the Middle Ages, right? Mm-hmm. How does he call them? Have you sort of, I think he does it a couple of times. He calls them the German a couple of times, which is kind of, it was sometimes, like all the northern languages that were called the Germans, there's still people sometimes struggle in documents because they are looking for a Dutch person, then it's called the German one. So you can imagine how frustrating that is. But he's also calling them barbarians. So he's making a big lump altogether of the migrations in the, like when the Roman Empire fell.
They sacked Rome anyway, didn't they?
Yeah. And it's and all the period where like the German Holy Empire formed, all the Middle Ages, it's just this whole period that they just invaded, they just sacked, they just ruined everything. They're barbarians. So it's a really ideological stance. It's not neutral. It's really saying, it's not that we are closer to the good Roman antiquity. So, I mean, it could have made sense. You mentioned the Sack of Rome. There was another Sack of Rome, right, at the beginning of the 16th century. In 1527, the emperor of the Holy Roman Empire, Charles V, had some problems with the Roman Catholic Church. They were already fighting over the Reformed churches. But again, they in that respect, Charles V tried to keep it all together. So he was trying to say, well, it doesn't matter what my subject believe in, as long as they keep being my subjects. Okay. But then other things, I mean, they weren't really going well between Rome and himself. And so something happened, like he guided his troops, his armies, to descend on Italy. And they arrived, they sacked through Italy all the northern part until Rome, and they looted Rome for a couple of months in 1527. The Pope had to flee, not to become a prisoner.
Wow.
It's not the first time. It's not the last time. It happens again with Napoleon. So it really is not a novelty, but it's a big thing for them. for people who live in Italy at that time and they identify with the rulers that are from Italy. Another thing, especially in Vasari's time, there are not that many Italian states that are still independent from foreign powers. Because most of northern Italy and all south of Italy is under the Spanish crown. It's under the Habsburg Spanish crown. So there's a couple of in central Italy. There's the Papal State, and then there's Tuscany. So, I mean, it is a thing to say, well, I mean, we're still thriving, we're still there, and, well, actually, the closest to them, you're just barbarians. So it's a funny way to look at things, but it's what I'm trying to tell you is, by placing into context things, there's other things, there's tropes, there's other things going on. But still, placing work in context makes you sort of wonder how these connections actually work in the mind of the same person who wrote this. So, yeah, poor Germans, they took the bad side of it. But.
And this is the bit that comes towards the order to build churches for Christian works, and not only did the religion destroy the most honourable temples of the pagan. Idols, but in order to ennoble and adorn Paul's with more ornaments that it originally possessed, it plundered the column of stone on the tomb of Hadrian.
I had some more slices as well, and one of these is actually this one, just to show you that a way of using the antique is also a very material one. Can you see all the holes in the Colosseum? Those holes that they are gripples of metal, they were gripples of metal to keep the stones, the huge slab stones in place. But throughout the Middle Ages, metal was much sought after for making weapons. So it all vanished. It still miraculously stood up because of its own weight. But yet again, it doesn't show here, but there are areas that collapse. Actually, this other shell, it's partially collapsed because things couldn't keep up anymore. Yes. So there's also, and you could also burn marble. So some stuff got lost because if you burn marble, you get a thing that's close to plaster, mortar.
Oh, really?
You get mortar.
Good. Oh, so you can use it for something else.
Yes, for building.
Yes.
Rome is made of Roman antique art in the sense that it's the buildings.
They use the marble up.
Yeah, they just use it. It's still there. And the Castel Sant'Angelo is the tomb of Hadrian. So now it's a papal, it's a Vatican thing, and they did all this. Okay. The Roman building arrived just here. This little portico, loggia, and all this part, it's modern. It's a Renaissance part. They just built on top of it. So, but he's also saying after that, like, they didn't do that out of hatred of genius, only to condemn to eradicate the gods of the pagans. So it's, I think he's trying to make a point that it's not entirely the
barbaric.
The Christian civilization is not entirely barbaric, but it's so blinded by this campaign against paganity that it's in old times. Unfortunately, it led to the loss of very important things. I think this speaks about a kind of like what we're saying, the historical perspective, that kind of looking at things not only in a sort of scientific way. These are great works of art, no matter the religion they supported. I mean, he's still mentioning God here and there, right? It doesn't come off as an entirely secular writer, right? He's how many times he speak of godlike, being like God. So, and just say that there's the difference between the parts is kind of easy to understand between the first and the other two, because the first is still so much the children. But then, what do you think he's trying to say in the difference between the second and the third? Feel free, it's just a way of reading the text. It's not like there's no right answer. Is it sort of saying that, like the things like style and order, where maybe painters exalting one of these or the other, but then in the third time, in the third generation, they became so good at each of them all together. So I think it's a way. When we say nowadays, they are a Renaissance man. To mean of someone who does everything well.
Yes. Exactly.
Isn't that the thing behind?
Oh, yes, because he says it's certainly true, although greatness in art is achieved by some artists through hard work, by others through study, by others through imitation.
Yeah, yeah.
Because Leonardo is probably the Renaissance man of the time. Yeah. Leonardo da Vinci, definitely.
Definitely. He's a great example because he's one of the few that was really into science and engineering. Yes.
Amazing intellect.
Yeah, and I mean, there's so much to whatever, I don't know, things you can pick up from nowadays, science or technology. Like he studied crystals in a way and how they can reflect light, almost like in a camera. So it's just amazing. So he's a very he's in a league of his own, because there weren't so many interested in science. But I mean, people like Raphael, they did almost everything. They did printing, they did architect. Michelangelo was a sculptor, a painter, an architect. So I mean, it's this thing of being. The more you get towards the third age, the more you have this. You have to examine the fine arts, because people in artists in the second one. I think he mentions Verrocchio as well. He was a goldsmith. Ghiberti was a goldsmith as well.
A lot of them were goldsmiths, weren't they?
Yeah,
is that the fine art side of it all?
Yes, there's a lot of it, because it's valuable things that you can that are sought after, but also because goldsmithry is how they got back to fusing bronze. Fusing bronze, it's a technique that again, it's a broad way of saying got lost for the Middle Ages, in the sense that they weren't doing it in a way that didn't work most of the times. Didn't work all the times. So it's a pupil of Ghiberti, Donatello, who is able to do for the first time a technique that's called lost blocks. So you do a little model in clay, and then you cover it with, it's called refractory clay. So it's another type of clay that actually doesn't burn. So you get the outer shell, and then you cover it with wax. So, and then add a refractory clay, and you have a big cube. So you don't see it anymore, your original model that is laid down there. And then the liquid bronze is poured into from on top. So you need a little hole. Sorry, I forgot. You need a hole that gets into the outer shell of wax. And the bronze that's liquid and it's so very high in temperature just gets rid of all the wax. So you just have the outer shell. And it's a unique thing. So one thing they couldn't do that again as well, they couldn't do big size unique pieces anymore. They struggled, so they did just parts and they fonded them together. But in these times, and I don't remember if I...
They did huge doors, didn't they? Huge bronze doors.
But they're all panels.
Yeah.
It's not a single one.
Right.
So it's a big thing. I don't know if I Yeah, it's up with like other things to show. Yes, this is a way of saying that there's a loss of connection between the different generations, and so. But it's Ghiberti is very influential because it's his pupils, Brunelleschi and Donatello, that bring about things like Brunelleschi architecture-wise, the dome again, Donatello, lots of things sculpture-wise, the wax and the procedures, and also he's the first one to do big sculptures on statues of people on horse, so equestrian statues. Mm-hmm. I don't remember if I have it here. Sorry. Oh yes.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So. It. I mean, it's you go into a city, how many you can find?
Mm.
It's there. So he was great because I personally love him. So these are slides to show you that everything happens at the same time. So it's not cookie cutter. So if you look at the wooden sculpture, it's not very, again, serene, Olympian kind of classicity. So they were doing things at the same time. So it was just to show you this. But yes, it's a story also of retrieving techniques.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, that's amazing.
How things simply by word of mouth can pass from workshop to another. Mm-hmm. But then now they become subjects of books. Of printing has an influence because things become much more. Don't we say like black and white?
Oh, yes, because I thought it was black and white.
Yeah, it was. So, the passages are there's a lot of names dropping because he's sort of doing a preface. So he's saying, I would mention this and that and etc. So just to show you because it's a great piece. Where perspective is used for the first time. This, the one on the right is a crappy one, but just to show you that if you get closer, the people painted in the fresco are the same size you would conceive them if they were at the level of the wall.
Oh.
So it's really lifelike. Even perspective is a lifelike skill of the artist because it lets you get into a writer of this time, Leopoldo Alberti, speaks of a window onto reality. It's like entering a place. It's real for you. So
where's that?
This is Santa Maria Novella in Florence. It's if you happen to be in Florence, it's very easy to visit it because it's just a minute away from the main train station. It's literally behind it.
Right.
So it's Dominican from a convent. So since it's a Dominican convent, they're really wealthy. They became wealthy, influential, I say, not wealthy in the financial terms. So there's a lot of art within the church that's beautiful to visit. This is a bit weird because it became then plaster became forgotten, and they used plaster on it. So it just floats in the middle of nothing. But the entire wall was painted, so you have to imagine that.
Mm.
Just that nowadays, unfortunately, it's just a piece in the wall.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But again, and it's. One of the first times where mathematical perspective is used, because it has to consider that there are a lot of ways of doing perspective. Leonardo does another one. He does what he calls aerial perspective. So the further something is, the worse you can see it. So everything is blurred and bluish. And I don't know if you've seen paintings by him. Everything is bluish in the background. So it's his way, because he studied vision. He said, well, actually, it's just a matter of losing vision. It's not that things become tiny. It's just that your eye cannot reach them.
Okay.
So, I mean, it's being an artist, you have a lot of set of tools and skills. So it was not the only way of doing perspective, and Flemish painters did another way. So yeah, this was a bit more like a little like horse ride through pieces that I think are really nice to look at to understand things. Like this is Leonardo at the beginning. He was doing these things in the workshop of Verrocchio. So, and a nice way to, I mean, since we are talking about a history of generations, sometimes it's funny to read how many of these were painters, artists were the pupils of someone. Yes. So it's a
progression.
Yeah, it's a handing over. Mm. So. Mm. Yeah. I've tried to, so you'll get this, so then some of them are in kind of like in parallel to the text, so you can also go back and say, oh, well, who's this, I don't know, Giorgione, because I love it so much. Isn't this marvelous piece?
Yes.
It's just amazing. And again, this is kind of like a goddess. It's like it's Venus, but it's one of those river goddesses as well. Mm. She's sleeping. Mm.
Can I just ask the significance of the landscape in this? Mm-hmm. Your eye is drawn to the figure, but you're also drawn through to the
This
sort of to the town or whatever it is beyond.
Yeah, this is, it's kind of like invented because you cannot, in other paintings you can see, oh, this is actually this town or the other one. This is an invention, again, the idea that you can conjure things if you're an artist. And this is much the Venetian style. I wanted to put this image because Tuscan painting is not, Tuscan school, Central Italy school, is not that interested in the landscape. On the same level as the human figure. It's not that they don't paint landscapes at all, but yeah, I mean, the landscape is as important as you are drawn to it. Mm. Yeah. It's as important as the figure. Mm. And this is something that the Venetians or northern, eastern Italian painters are much more keen on. Austrian, the Danubian painters are also very keen on landscape, but they use it to reflect the protagonist. So they're always very, like, I don't know, stormy landscapes or idyllic landscapes. So it's another way of doing things, depending. Again, it's all a matter of perspective, what you want to find. You're looking things in a certain way, and you're finding what you're looking for, and you're choosing what you're looking for. So, kind of, unfortunately, it's random. So... again, I tend to speak a lot. I hope you enjoyed it anyway. If you have questions or things, again, feel free to ask Jane if you have things that pop up in your mind later on, or just I'm sorry that I kept on talking much more.
That's good.
Hope you enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Can I just ask you something?
Yeah.
The grotesque. You know, you get a lot of that figures in illuminated manuscripts that were produced by the Lindisfarne. Is there any joining of that? I mean, did one come from another, or was it all from myths? Or again, people don't know what they mean. They don't know the significance of these creatures by and large. But
I think it's the same thing that kept on being done. It's definitely, again, things weren't, they didn't happen all of a sudden, so they didn't got lost all of a sudden. Mm. So in decoration, they kept on doing all monstrous creatures and weird things or decorations, because it was something that painters were doing, so that they passed on. So, but again, as you said, it a bit lost the original meaning and also projected other meanings. So it's sometimes they're interpreted as the populations that are still not converted, or I don't know, this is the realm of evil, and then the word of God is the realm of good.
Yeah.
So this it's another interpretation of it. But it's still the same, like people with giant ears and
that's right.
And monstrous rabbits. There's so many rabbits that are doing all the... much enjoyed it. It was a pleasure.
Yes, thank you very much.
Yeah.
That was lovely. Thank you.
Yeah. Beautifully visual.
Thank you.
Well supported.
Thank you. It was a pleasure for me to talk to you. So
I do come again.
Definitely. If I'm here next year, I'll ask David, because this thing keeps running every year, more or less, right?
Yes, yeah, it does. So
that was really good, thank you.
I'm sorry, so do you have another lift then?
Do I have another
lift to
No, I'm fine.
Okay, good.
I think.
Yeah.
I've got a lift, haven't I?
You certainly have.
I've forgotten your name.
Sandra.
Sandra.
That's right.
Yes, thank you very much.
If ever you're stuck, you'd never be stuck here. We'd always get you home.
That's
so,
right.
So, yes.
I'll be here in the bonus groups except the last one. Probably not the last one.
You're missing one as well. You're missing
probably the last one.